I'd like to introduce our speaker. It is my honor and privilege to introduce Penny Gill and attempt to tell you a little bit of who she is. Dr. Gill is a superb scholar, thinker, and political scientist. Her interest is rooted in deep caring for human beings and the societies that we create. For the past many years, she has been studying the brand new world we live in and can gesture at with the word globalization. The heart and soul of Penny's accomplishment, however, is contained in the honorable title, teacher. She has been teaching at Mount Holyoke College long enough to work with the daughters of former students. She is an ardent proponent of women's education. She works very hard at it, encouraging students to rewrite papers, teaching the skills of rigorous thought, research, and expression. Her concern is for the whole person. With the affirmation of themselves and the skills that her students acquire, they learn self-confidence. With self-respect grows the sense of responsibility and the passion to serve. They grow to honor their abilities and sense their power. Under her watchful and loving eye, they come to value their intuitions, recognize the callings of their hearts, and subject those higher leadings to the rigors of logical, disciplined thought. At present, Penny is dean of the college at Mount Holyoke. It is a position she accepted out of her love for Mount Holyoke and her respect for its long tradition of excellence. She has used her interpersonal skills to dissolve the fears that create intra- and interdepartmental conflict in order to create more cooperative and productive working relationships among the faculty and the student body. For years, Penny has been practicing quieting herself, sitting in front of her keyboard and opening to receive energy from non-material sources of energy and wisdom that have named themselves to her Kuan Yin and Manjushri. The result is a book-length work, the beginning of a second, and a series of related shorter teachings. Before I encountered Penny, I was skeptical about channeled writing. The gravity of her career and the unassuming grace of her personality led me to invest in the effort to ask her for and read carefully the work she has produced. The brilliance, originality, timeliness, relevance, power, and hope contained within these writings stands on its own, and it has changed my life. It gives me great joy to share with you Dr. Penny Gill.
Thank you so much, Jim. I could thank almost everybody in this room. This is such a community project. Can you hear me in the back? At the same time, this project has been hidden, and it's time for it not to be hidden anymore. Jim has been my amanuensis, my prod. He was one of my very first readers. And through Jim's fingers, this manuscript has flowed out into the world in many directions. So I have deep, deep thanks to Jim, and of course, deep thanks to Carol for making sure that I kept sitting there. So what I'd like to do is, I don't usually write my talks, but I wanted you to hear the language, and so I wrote my talk. And there'll be plenty of time for Q&A. That's what feels most natural to me, is to do that. And we'll think about whether we're on this side of the street or the other side of the street when we get to that, okay? So thank you so much for coming. I'm so moved. This is a very, very, very big moment for me. We are here tonight to continue our discussion about peace. I would like to describe briefly the immense pressures we face as we worry about our world and our future. We also sense we are in the midst of a profound transformation in every aspect of our local and global lives. Every dimension of human life and of planetary life seems to be under pressure. I will also share with you this evening a reframing of our global worries, which has been of immense help and encouragement to me and to many readers of this manuscript, about which I will tell you more as I go along. We live in a time of overwhelming crises. Long suppressed energies and desires burst forth into public view. We are both excited and overwhelmed. The world is shape-shifting before our eyes. U.S. dominance is challenged by new voices. American power is eroding in economies, global politics, control of the seas, and in the emerging developing world. The capitalist global market is not kind to all of us, and we are stunned by the greed and the thoughtlessness of the financial elite. Released from their bonds to territory and without obligations to any community, they roam the world, making bets on ephemeral financial instruments which reflect very little economic reality. The gaps between the privileged and the poor expand at alarming rates. The U.S. has not been this unequal in income and assets since the 1920s. Of course, this plays out in domestic and global politics all over the world. We have only to remember Michael Clare's sober analysis. Michael gave the first talk in this series of global energy resources, where they are, and who the dominant users are, to imagine cataclysmic conflicts in the near future. And we have not yet really examined the profound impact of climate change and the absolute requirement that we establish the conditions for long-term sustainability. But we gather tonight to discuss peace, how to create it, and how to deny ourselves the ancient tools of war. But to create peace, we must build the conditions for peace. Peace is much more than the absence of war. And the fundamental cause of war and aggression is human fear. I have been deeply privileged to receive over the last half dozen years a series of teachings which might be of real value as we struggle with these difficult questions. It all began some years ago as I wrote in my journal one morning of my profound grief over what was happening in the world. I wrote and I wrote, trying to name all I could see in my world that was heartbreaking. And I was suddenly interrupted. That is not how we see it. And thus began this long and rich conversation, if I may call it that, with some source way beyond me and way beyond my own center of thinking and understanding. So let me begin with a brief quotation about our subject tonight, peace, that is from that center, that is not my center. Humans say they want peace. There is peace studies, the Peace Corps, peace workers, peace petitions, peace protests, and peacekeepers. But there is no peace. These efforts cannot give birth to peace unless they go to a different level and ask, where is the fear? Who is fearful? You humans ask, who is right? Who is wrong? But those questions do not lead to peace. That is the argument that started the conflict in the first place. A conflict can only be resolved on a different level, and searching for the fear takes you to that different level. I have found the teachings to offer a complex and clear analysis of the current world situation and the truly extraordinary moment and transition we are in the midst of. The central themes are fear, the necessity to wake up and develop our consciousness, and then to recognize the profound and intimate interdependence we share with all beings on the planet. They describe the reinforcing perceptions and habits of mind, of ego, or of little self. The teachers call it little self all the time. I love that naming. They point to the self-destructive dimensions of individualism, competitiveness, and materialist views of reality. They show the dangers of science being our only reputable source of knowledge. And they remind us a world without humans is certainly imaginable. But that would be lost would be the best experiment so far at the universe becoming conscious of itself. Perhaps their most radical claim is that the fundamental impetus for this radical change comes from outside the global system. It is not the result of reform movements or a new ethics or a radical politics. It arises from a realm many of us deny even exists, a non-material realm of spirit. And I quote, "This is a time of profound transformation, and Earth is caught in the throes of it without having much understanding. This transformation has its origin in the cosmos, way beyond the ken of humans on Earth. It impacts Earth via immaterial energy, frequencies very different from those that materialize as form and shape in sentient beings or matter. Humans play an insignificantly tiny role in the Earth's energy systems, and Earth similarly plays an insignificant role in the cosmic energy system. One piece of this coming transformation is that humans must truly recognize that to become cosmically and astronomically literate would much improve human life altogether. There is a major energetic transformation underway within the cosmos, and it is beginning to have an impact on Earth and earthly life. Humans have no choice but to respond to it. The question is, what kind of response would be the most appropriate or the most cooperative with the transformation that's underway? And that is the purpose of this project. We wish to lay out the situation to help all the students understand it as deeply as possible. The more people who can recognize this reframed analysis of the troubles on Earth, the easier it will be, or the more likely it will be, that human responses can be sensible and appropriate. The usual way, human way, of describing these moments of cosmic transformation, or the infusion of unusually great amounts of energy from outside the solar or earthly system, is in apocalyptic terms. In fact, that is what apocalypse is. This time, the new energy does not appear as matter. The energy has not materialized. It is subtle, of a very high frequency, and very potent. It is setting the Earth's energy at a different frequency, which in turn will affect the functioning of every being on the planet. This you seem to have heard of, though you don't understand it at all. Think of it this way. The Earth is a singing bowl, and the regular flow of energy to it and around it has kept it singing a nice steady pitch for millions of years. Now someone comes along and runs a stick around the edge of it. The pitch shifts as the bowl gains more and more energy. The volume increases. The harmonics stretch out further. There is much more resonance, much more sympathetic vibration within the bowl and around it. You can feel it with your hands if you come close to the bowl. And this is what is happening to the earth. New and stronger pulses of energy are arriving, and the earth responds. It can't help but respond. The frequencies are higher and stronger. There is much more resonance, more harmonic pulses are released, and even electromagnetic forces shift in response. And the bowl sings at a different pitch. The small bowls around it begin to vibrate differently as well. It really is simple to visualize, but it is very abstract, and it is still only a visual metaphor. What does it really mean concretely in how organisms live? This energy generates changes on every level of planetary life. The revolution in consciousness, or even in simple knowledge, would be when humans recognize that the major elements shaping human life on Earth are not human and not material, but non-material and non-human. That was a long quote. But I wanted you to sense how the language works and how abstract and clear it is. There is powerful assurance there are many people all over the world, just like us, waking up, rubbing our sleep-filled eyes, looking for a good cup of coffee, and wondering what to do next. That's us. That's who's here tonight. We expand our abilities to receive more subtle frequencies of energy, and that in turn helps us imagine more complex views of reality and to connect with others doing the same thing. And the teachers say, lights are flashing on all over the earth, and each one is a person waking up, recognizing his or her interdependence with all the others, and beginning a much more active involvement in the enormous issues of the day. We are being invited to make, quote, a quantum leap in consciousness, which will dramatically alter human behavior. Quantum leaps, even for electrons, are very arduous energetically. Humans are gathering up energy, but you don't know how to use it skillfully. It triggers all manner of neurotic and psychotic processes, especially fear. And when fearfulness receives such a deep energetic charge, it fuels intense paranoia, aggression, conflict, and violence. But this energy can be harnessed and used to shift consciousness. If you do not see this much larger picture, you will only see the suffering and the violence, and you will believe it is the end of human life as you know it. And that is the error of your thinking. That last paragraph was the teacher's. This is not the teacher's. And so we will connect with each other. Here I am always reminded of the wonderful image from India of Indra's net and its contemporary incarnation of sorts, the World Wide Web. Both are potent images of our interdependence on so many levels. One of the most positive qualities of globalization is that it makes visible our material, concrete interdependence. We see the dense web of communication elaborating itself, bringing unimaginable possibilities of being in touch, of networking, of learning from each other and building on each other's experience, and finding cheer and encouragement as we discover we are not at all alone in our hopes and our dreams. The teachings prompt us to explore these possibilities more deeply and remind us these processes are underway on every level of reality. We are reminded frequently to keep a focus on the biggest possible picture, cosmic history, the nearly unimaginable idea that humans are the great experiment of mind, the universe becoming conscious of itself. If so, it would be our great and honorable task and source of meaning. But how do we do this? Fear is the fundamental obstacle, and much of this long manuscript gives instruction on how to dissolve fear. That is the practical core of the teachings, and I will return to that in a moment. I take comfort from the teacher's reminders that we live in a society riddled with fear, and there are ample reasons why we are fearful individuals. Fortunately, that is also the most effective level for the fear transformative work. Our American society is notable both for its materialist views and its hyper-individualism. This misunderstands both our biology and our humanity. Many reactions to that from both left and right, and I think of the evangelicals and the family values, the fundamentalist versions of every great religious tradition, the mistrust of new biological discoveries, etc. You can add your own list. But those reactions express the deep unease about the trajectory of American values and politics, and in that sense must be taken seriously. I find some calm that is not just me who thinks I live in a deeply flawed, neurotic, and violent culture. I am, after all, not alone in these perceptions, and there are many possibilities for identifying allies and building coalitions. And this counters my lifelong pessimism about human and global affairs. It literally encourages me. Globalization brings us many positive possibilities, but it also embeds us in an extremely complex system. What are some of its main features, and how do they impact our ability to act and to create a more sustainable and peaceful world? While that could be our topic for a year's worth of study and discussion, let me just point to a couple of significant aspects of our national and world systems now. Global capitalism. We can neither manage nor control our economy, not production or finance or distribution. That's the first time that's ever been true. Two, global communications. There are massive floods of information drowning us in the knowledge of terrible problems on every continent over which we have little influence and can do little or nothing to solve in the short term. Three, competitive individualism undermines community, our ability to imagine a public good, and our belief that we can develop skillful means to pursue it. Four, increasing marketization, which is often linked to privatization, another form of undermining communitarian values and institutions, in which markets penetrate further and further into arenas long considered inappropriate for privatization or competition. In markets, we become a commodity, not a citizen and not an actor. Perhaps worse, markets are unable to balance multiple values or prioritize non-quantifiable or non-economic values. Five, we have a deeply unresponsive political system, except to money. As a citizenry, we actually understand very little about how our political system actually works. Six, there is an obsession with security, rational in a society with very few safety nets and few community mutual obligations to each other. I've lost count. Am I seven? We are surrounded by a culture of fear, anxiety, and violence, omnipresent in old and new forms of media. Many self-medicate with alcohol, drugs, and entertainment. We tolerate levels of violence in everyday life that astonish most non-Americans. All of these factors interact, reinforcing each other. One outcome is that we are paralyzed and immobilized by fear. We can't see any way forward. We no longer believe in our own powers as citizens or even as responsible adults. We consider ourselves literally powerless, and we believe we are isolated individuals without forms of connection and community. Of course, we are unable to act effectively, for we don't even believe it is possible to have a significant impact. How can we untangle these processes and structures so we can begin to reclaim our full ability to act on our own behalf and on behalf of our communities and the next generations? Let's start with a primary characteristic of American culture, which has profoundly shaped our economy, society, and political institutions: American individualism. On one hand, it provides us with wide opportunities for freedom and creativity and personal development. On the other, it intensifies our sense of social isolation, feeds competitiveness in so many realms of life, and sharpens our fearfulness. It undermines our social bonds and our ability to mobilize the resources of our community in pursuit of common goals. So, what is the primary task? How can we access our own personal and shared community visions of where we long to go? How can we excavate the fear and hopelessness and powerlessness in each of our own minds and hearts and heal that so we can release our creative energy, build community, and network with each other and others around our region, our country, and the world? We must heal ourselves of our fear in order to free ourselves to recreate and re-energize our communities. And then we must find skillful ways to assist others to also uncover their own fears and discover their own hopes and energies for this shared work. What are some of those widely shared fears? I will list some of mine. I have no power, no way to impact or even resist these terrible global processes. I'm powerless in the face of overwhelming natural and political and economic disasters. I have nothing to bring to this enormous problem. I'm not skilled or useful or knowledgeable or even worthwhile. I'm too vulnerable and insecure myself to worry about these huge issues. I believe it's every person for herself, and it is all a zero-sum game. If others win, I and those I love will surely lose. I'm just one person, all alone. I'm stuck in my neurotic fears, and it is impossible to find fellow travelers or others who might share my worries and hopes. And who do these fears and beliefs serve? That's a teacherly question. It might not immediately make sense, but think about it. When we believe we are powerless or ignorant or incapable of changing things, we don't challenge or resist those who gain from our silence and our passivity. I'm certainly not a conspiracy theorist, and I don't believe there is a cabal somewhere manipulating the levers of power to protect themselves and their great privileges and resources. There doesn't need to be a cabal to do that. But it is quite clear that our silence and resignation serves to buttress the privileges and injustices of our society and our politics. So acquiescence is also a political act or a posture with deep political implications. We have only to study Egypt, Libya, or Tunisia to see this clearly. Your efforts here in Leverett this winter and spring to stimulate conversations about peace, to bring people together to think and learn together, to create spaces and opportunities to connect, join others, and begin to imagine first steps. Here, on the most local level imaginable, is, of course, a perfect example of moving from acquiescence towards action, from despair and discouragement to hopefulness and vision, and from isolation to discovering rich networks right here in this precious town. What a gift that has been, and how provocative and inspiring to those of us from neighboring towns in the Pioneer Valley. Don't imagine for a minute that there is anyone here in this wonderful hall tonight who does not have some fear down deep in his or her belly. Asleep, perhaps, way below awareness, or beginning to rumble, which is a lot scarier, believe me. We are all in this together, every one of us. If you aren't frightened about what's happening in our world, you are definitely not paying attention. And in our world includes our own world, Leverett and the Pioneer Valley, our homes and families, the air we breathe, the food we eat, and the energy we depend on. There are at least two very good reasons for embarking on the fear work. First, it really does dissolve the major obstacle to our getting together on behalf of our critical shared values and visions. But second, being gripped by fear, aware of it or not, is also the major obstacle to increased consciousness. Hence the title of my talk, Fear or Consciousness, Dare We Change? That really is the choice in front of us. So how do we do this? The teacher offers a very simple set of steps, and now I'm quoting again. The first step is to name your fears. To name a deep or strong emotion is often to begin to weaken its effects, and sometimes even to disarm it. The second step is to stand still and try to interrupt the cascade of denials, resistances, defenses, and narratives. To hold still and experience the fear in one's body and in one's mind, and then to watch it flood into every corner of your being, is a quite stunning experience for most people, especially the first time. The second step, then, is to stop the automatic cycles, which are intended to quench and contain that fear. The third step follows immediately if there really has been a full stop. It can take a little practice to get yourself to calm enough to be able to actually interrupt the narratives and watch the fear start to rumble. But once you get the hang of it, it's not a big deal. Once you get the hang of it, you actually can really slow that process down and it stops. One watches the fear. Where does it go? How does it communicate its presence? How does it mobilize your body? How does it shut down parts of your mind and yourself? How does it affect your best self? How does it affect your least developed self? So that third step initiates a lifetime of paying attention to oneself in new ways. This lifelong self-inquiry is one of the most powerful tools available to a human being for expanding awareness and opening the heart center. This becomes the great highway of opening modes for communicating with others in body and out of body, your species and other species. It is life-giving and life-enriching work. The fourth step is really interesting. How does one then change her life as she becomes much more conscious of how fear has permeated her being? What is the fruit of relieving oneself of the burdens of fearfulness and of choosing to leave the territory of the reign of fear. The usual results are profound insights, explosions of creativity, much more freedom in speech and action, and dramatic shifts in intimate and personal relationships. And through all of this, every step, one must practice compassion for oneself, compassion for the wounded, fearful part of you, compassion for the brave and steady part of you, trying to unravel the layers of hurt and unease. You must breathe compassion to yourself and wrap that terrified part in compassion. Dissolving our fears layer by layer, releases founts of energy, energy which had been used to contain and repress those fears and keep us out of trouble. I doubt I speak only for myself when I report that with each little plug of fear recognized and released, I receive a strong burst of new energy, new stamina, a new willingness to take a risk, stick my neck out, and get out of one of the boxes I spend far too many days inside of. Releasing an old buried fear gives us access to new sources of energy, as well as everything else that got caught up in that fear, buried there like a fossil in amber. It heals the deep psyche with its old bits of wounded self. Perhaps most significantly, it can open us up to new levels of reality. For we fear most of all that which is invisible and unknown to our five reliable senses. This is no surprise, as we live in an astonishingly materialist culture. Despite the alleged religiosity at the heart of American society. As we learn slowly, I should add, that what we see is not all there is. There is a parallel realization that ego's view is not the whole story. Each step of releasing a fear allows us to open our horizon of consciousness a bit further, to include more people, more points of view, more dimensions of reality, more understandings of what is reality. I like the vague words of expansive, inclusive, complex, to suggest how much richer a mental and emotional world is available to us. But of course, complex suggests as well that we must seek to relate with people in dramatically different worldly positions and to address seriously, elaborately different points of view. This is really hard work, as many of you know, but softening the boundaries of our consciousness both makes this possible and then helps it to bear fruit. And one truly gorgeous piece of fruit, nay, a cornucopia of fruit, is a gradually emerging awareness of our fundamental interdependence. Then we know that a profound fear is surely dissolving, that the isolation from which we suffer so is being breached, and that we begin to understand that we have allies everywhere we look. Ego, I might add, at least our good old American version of ego, has taken a really serious hit in this process. And that is cause for celebration. We are also assured there will be colleagues. And I quote, "Colleagues are not what is missing. What is missing is your awareness of each other. Then you can build cooperative networks. Sometimes simply to communicate and share insights and information, and sometimes to organize sustained action together. These are vastly more effective and are the perfect examples of how the whole is so much greater than the sum of its parts. Energy is generated, sustained, and then directed at a particular point of leverage." So human fear causes war. Powerful shifts of energy are upending many traditional structures and ways of doing things around the globe. It is a crisis point, surely, but it is also a point of extraordinary opportunity. We can remake our communities and we can remake our world. There are no shortcuts, and the work is long and arduous. It requires many citizens around the globe to dissolve their deepest fears and begin the work of envisioning a humane, just, and sustainable world. We are certainly not alone in this longing, and we should be making constant efforts to reach ever more deeply into local and global networks of peace builders. Our first step is to be diligent about bringing up our own fears, layer after layer, neutralizing them first, and then wrapping them in compassion, where they can no longer drive our behavior. Step by step, we release the stranglehold and the false judgments of ego and its deeply wired neuroses in each of us. Then it is easy to open to spirit and the many sources of wisdom, in whatever shape and form fits you best. And to give the teachers the last word. All you who work for social justice and all the good-hearted people of the world must find your joy and your trust again. You are all working without really trusting that you are moving with human history. You experience yourselves as shoring up small pieces of social organization in the face of hurricanes of disaster. Your world, what really animates your world, must become much more spacious. You must learn to think cosmically, for only that will give you adequate access to the energy and joy of spirit. Thank you very much.